Hello, listeners. Elise and I are so happy to be back talking about the second season of And Just Like That, but we've also been working on another project, our Patreon podcast. For just $4 a month, you'll get 3 to 4 episodes detailing a New York-set romantic comedy. Right now, we're in the middle of Moonstruck, so I wanted to give you all a chance to hear part one. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Still Wondering Moonstruck, part one. Well, hey, Elise Castle.
Hey, Mike Jensen.
How are you doing today?
I am great. We are here to talk about Moonstruck, which I have to start this off by telling you my backstory with the movie Moonstruck.
Okay.
Because it actually plays a part in my adolescence.
Sure. Okay.
So when I was in high school, I went to a performing arts high school for half the day, and one of my favorite teachers in the entire world, Mr. G, he was in charge of that school. He was great. I loved him. One of the best teachers I ever had. And one day, I don't remember why he decided to show us Moonstruck. I mean, I'm assuming because it's a great film and it's John Patrick Shanley and it has a lot of great performances, but I don't know if it was one of those, like, we're not feeling good, so we're going to watch a movie day, or if there was a reason behind it. But anyway, he rolled in the TV, as you would do in the, you know, early 2000s, late 90s, and put on Moonstruck. And I was just like a bratty teen who was kind of bored. And I can imagine why this film may have not inspired somebody who was like a teenager at that time. And after, he was like, so what did you think? And I was like, worst movie ever. And he was like, what? This movie is brilliant. And I was like, worst movie I've ever seen. Terrible. So it became a long running, because I just slept through it. And it became a long running joke all through high school, even until we are now friends on Facebook. And I think a few years ago, he just like sent me Moonstruck and nothing else. Like, it's just become like this long running joke that I will never watch Moonstruck. It's a terrible film. When I graduated high school, he bought me the script for Moonstruck. So that's all. I just thought it was very funny that was such a...
Do you think that you'll reach out and tell him that you've rewatched it?
Yes, 100%. I will give him Patreon access to listen to this episode. So if you are listening, Mr. G, I make an amends to you. This is a brilliant film. Cher's performance is incredible. And now I see what you are trying to do. You're trying to teach the children the magic of Moonstruck and Cher.
I thought you were going to say it is only the second worst movie.
Yeah, it is only the second worst movie next to, I don't know what the worst
movie
is.
The one you just said we're not going to do, but we won't say the title of it.
No, it's fine. I sometimes like am scouting movies to think of things we could do. And I watched Sleeping with Other People last night and I just wasn't a fan. I only watched like an hour of it and said, I'm not going to finish this.
Well, okay. So my history with Moonstruck, I don't really have much of one. I had seen this before. This is one of those films that I probably watched on VHS somewhere in my 20s or early 30s and didn't really have a strong impression of, sort of. I also had a not great impression of it, but for different reasons. And we'll talk about that more as we go along. But I do remember certain aspects. Obviously, it was a big thing in pop culture. And I do remember watching the Academy Awards the night that well, now we're getting to the end, but I do remember Olympia Dukakis up on stage. Spoiler. But let's start at the beginning, because you know why?
It's a very good place to start.
Thank you.
We have our DVD description. A full moon, a New York City night, and love and music in the air. One of the most enchanting romantic comedies of all time assembles a flawless ensemble cast for a tender and boisterously funny look at a multi-generational Italian-American family in Brooklyn, wrestling with the complexities of love and marriage at every stage of life. At the center of it all is a radiant Cher as Loretta, an unlucky in love bookkeeper whose feelings about her engagement to the staid Johnny are thrown into question after she meets his hot-blooded brother, Ronnie. And one night at the opera changes everything. Winner of the Academy Awards for Best Actress, Supporting Actress, and Original Screenplay, this modern-day fairy tale is swept along on passionate Puccini melodies and directed by master storyteller Norman Jewison with the heightened emotion to match. So we have Moonstruck. This is written by John Patrick Shanley and directed by Norman Jewison. And I want to start by talking about John Patrick Shanley. You know, he'd been a playwright for years. I believe his first produced play was called Welcome to the Moon. So he had a thing for the moon this whole time.
And he'd made a little bit of money off of his second play, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, which is actually playing right now off-Broadway, and I'm interested in seeing it, or it's starting sometime.
Aubrey Plaza?
Yeah, interesting cast. I'm thinking, maybe I'll score a ticket and talk about that later. But, you know, so he was actually making his living painting apartments and working for, like, driving a moving van, like working for a moving company. But he received a $17,500 check from the National Endowment for the Arts and basically said to himself, like, I can live off this check for 1 year. But at the end of the year, he knew that he'd be back to painting and moving. So he thought, you know, I'm going to write a movie. And he started reading screenplays. He read the screenplays to American Gigolo and Scarface, and he actually kind of didn't like them. Like, he thought they were sort of ridiculous, and their descriptions were kind of ridiculous. And then as he sort of came to understand it better, he was like, oh, no, it's just about perspective. It's about, like, figuring out how to describe something and figuring out your own way to do it. And he had just moved to 177th Street and Fort Washington, which at the time in the mid 80s was a very dangerous neighborhood. He sort of talked about how there was, like, murders and robberies taking place all the time. And he was living in this little apartment with one window that had no gate. And he would sort of, like, sit in his apartment thinking, like, he kept a baseball bat next to his bed thinking, like, I just in case someone breaks into my apartment. And he sort of started thinking about, like, you know, the violence of the neighborhood. And this inspired him to write a film called Five Corners. Now, I had never heard of this film before. He somehow got funding actually through George Harrison, The Beatle.
The Beatle.
Yeah. And it starred Jodie Foster, Tim Robbins, John Turturro. It seemed like it was a pretty massive flop. But then as I looked at it, I realized it wasn't even released in the U.S. until after Moonstruck's wide release. And I will say that Jodie Foster won an Independent Spirit Award. So he sort of talked about, like, getting that produced and at that point now living near the George Washington Bridge and having holes in his walls and things kind of being crappy. Like, it was not a very good apartment, but sort of having the perspective of, like, what if I just thought everything was great? What if everything was wonderful? And he kind of decided to write a script with, like, romance involved and kind of, like, leading with positivity, if that makes any sense. And, like, looking at, like, the romantic sides of things. And he actually wrote, well, he actually had a meeting with Sally Field, and she was sort of talking to her about his idea of writing this script, and she was very into it. So he actually sat down and wrote this script with Sally Field in mind and then presented it to her. And for the record, she really liked it. She thought it was a great script, but he was looking for someone to option it. Like, he needed someone to pay some amount of money to just get the ball rolling. And she, you know, it's sort of an axiom in show business, like, never spend your own money. So it makes sense that she, in the end, was like, I'm not going to put any money towards this, but if you find a producer, you know, let me know. And, you know, it would have cost her around, like, $25,000 to option it, and it would have made her a producer. But once again, like, hindsight's 20/20, and she decided not to do that. And you know, if we sort of then flip over to Norman Jewison, you know, he'd been directing film and television for decades, since, like, 1952, I think, is his first credit. And kind of most famously directed Fiddler on the Roof, In the Heat of the Night, I think won Best Picture, Jesus Christ Superstar, the movie version. He had done Agnes of God right before this, a film that I love. And he came across this script and talks about how it was very, like, coffee stained, which was sort of your way of knowing that a lot of people had read it. It had been sort of, like, passed around and literally been passed around. Like, nobody wanted to produce it. Nobody was really into it. But he read it and thought, well, this is brilliant. And at the time, it was called The Bride and the Wolf, which he immediately was like, this is a terrible title. Everyone's going to think it's a horror film. And so they kind of went through other titles, and for a long time it was called Moonglow. Cher says that she only ever knew it as Moonstruck. And then, you know, turning to Cher, the other major participant in this film, she actually was going to turn it down. She was in the middle of filming Witches of Eastwick, and I would love to hear the story behind this, because in many different forums... So once again, I have the DVD, not the DVD, I have the Blu-ray, the Criterion Collection Blu-ray, so much bonus features. I will try to filter and funnel as much as I can. But, like, in three separate places, Cher is like, I was doing Witches of Eastwick and I have some stories to tell.
Is this where you get most of your information? Like, you're saying a lot of information. Now, is most of this coming from your research you've done from, like, the director's commentary, or is this internet? I just think, like, if the listeners want to learn more.
Yeah, it's a bit all of the above, but a lot of it is that this Blu-ray does have commentary from Cher, Norman Jewison, and John Patrick Shanley.
Okay, so this isn't just one article that you found that you're, like, reading from. You're, like,
this is all over the place and, like, watching behind-the-scenes footage and interviews.
Mike Jensen is not a plagiarist.
No. I did so much research. This is, like, interviews from, like, 1987 all the way through 2020 that I read tons of stuff. And it's one of those commentaries where they're clearly not in the room together, so someone did a very good job of sort of splicing it together to make it sound conversational. But basically, because she was in the middle of doing whatever this perhaps grueling filming of Witches of Eastwick, and she had two other films lined up already. So she told her agent, she was like, tell them that I can't do it. And her agent basically said, I want you to tell them. Meet with them and you tell them that you can't do it. So she got together with Norman Jewison and John Patrick Shanley. And basically by the end of the meeting, when she was supposed to say, like, I can't do it, was like, I'm really looking forward to it. Can't wait to get started. So that's kind of how we got into this. So we get into this film. And I will say that the film originally began with the sounds of the opera, because we see them sort of loading in the flats for the opera and the sets. And it was supposed to start out with like a tap, tap, tap of a baton and then go directly into La Boheme, which doesn't really have much of an overture, apparently. It kind of goes right into the music. And when they did an original test screening, the test screening went terribly. People immediately were like, are we watching an opera? Like, is this an art house film? And apparently no one started laughing at any jokes until like 30 minutes into it.
Which is interesting because I was on the phone with a friend who's a music supervisor, and we were talking. I had said, all right, I have to go take notes on Moonstruck. And he started telling me all this interesting stuff about Moonstruck and the opera and La Boheme, and it really inspired me to do a deep dive more into like that work. And some of the stuff I was finding is that Moonstruck itself, and I don't know if they talk about this in the director's cut, that it actually plays like an opera, like the actual acting. Okay, great.
Yeah, we'll definitely layer that in as we go along, because there's some interest, because I don't know almost anything about opera. So when you had sort of brought that up of the opera being part of the structure, like, once again, I know little things from what they say, but I'm curious to know what you have to say about it. And basically they sort of took a look at the film and they were like, well, it's not working. It's immediately not working. And what are we going to do? And Norman Jewison is on record as saying he hates the song That's Amore. Like, he doesn't like this song. He doesn't like this recording. But when they started playing it over the opening, he immediately was like, yeah, no, this is exactly what the tone of the film is. This is exactly how it's supposed to go.
It sets it, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we start with the full moon and That's Amore and the Brooklyn Bridge and all these various shots of New York at night. And then we cut to Lincoln Center and the Met, and we see that the Met is doing La Boheme, opening November 15th. Now, did you look at this poster?
I did look at this poster. I meant to screenshot it. And I, in order to watch this, because it is on Showtime,
is it on Showtime? Okay.
So I had to like get I got a free trial for Showtime. And usually when I pause things, it just paused oddly.
Absolutely.
It like blurred it as I paused. So I couldn't really read it. And I was like, you know, I'll go back. And then I forgot.
All right. Well, I did all the work. I did the work on this one. So here we go. Conducted by Roger Paradiso, who on this film was the unit production manager. La Boheme is being produced by Louis Gould, who on Moonstruck was the first assistant director. Set design for La Boheme by Philip Rosenberg, who was the production designer for Moonstruck. Costume designer by Theoni Aldridge, who was the costume designer on Moonstruck. Lighting designer David Watkin, who was the director of photography on Moonstruck. And stage director Gregory Palmer, who was the second assistant director on Moonstruck. So a lot of the crew members get little shout outs on the poster here, which I really like. And then we cut to Loretta Castorini, Cher.
Mm-hmm.
She's at West Houston on Sullivan Street. Don't stalk me. I work so close to this location. Like, I was like, yeah, I know that corner. I know that. Because it looks exactly the same. Like, so much of this looks exactly the same.
Well, something interesting about New York in general is, I remember when I first moved to New York, I said that for such a huge city, it does feel at times like we're still operating in the way that we did 50, 60 years ago. And in so many, like restaurants, for example, if you're ever walking through New York City in the morning where there's a lot of restaurants, you'll see all of the hatches open that literally open from the sidewalk with stairs going into the basement, with trucks coming and deliveries being made. You will see, like, I think it was, which was it? You've Got Mail, where the bakeries will just leave huge paper bags of bread, like, outside.
Yes.
Like, this stuff it's all wild. Really, really happens. And part of it feels very old school, but then you think of the infrastructure of the actual city and the restaurants, and I don't even know if that's the right word, that it has to be that way, because that's how it was built, and it would be too hard to not do things that way.
And New York is, I mean, you know, we did talk about this with You've Got Mail, that New York really is just a series of tiny towns that are all connected to each other, and things are either exactly how they looked 100 years ago, or they were built last week.
Yep.
Like, it's such a combination of, like, it's been around forever, or this opened yesterday.
Yeah, or, like, I remember putting out the awning for the restaurant that we worked at, and now it's electric. Like, there's a button you press that never works, by the way. But but before that, we would go out with the whirly-do, oh, which was, like, this long pole, and have to, like, crank it out. Yeah. And that's just what
your,
you do.
Like, arm exercise.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems sort of silly, I suppose, to talk about Cher and who she is, but I do want to point out that, you know, Cher obviously has been a huge deal for decades and decades. You know, decades before this film came out, she was already a huge star and had her own show and had several shows.
You better talk about Cher right now, because in our last thing, you just talked about her being broke, and that's not fair. So please tell about Cher's successes.
Well, what I think is funny, and, you know, I think this was back in the day with, like, a Behind the Music or something like that, that I remember Cher talking about, she had taken not a hiatus exactly, but she was sort of reinventing herself, that she had been this superstar, particularly with her then husband, and then branched off on her own, but then sort of had started to get first a theater and then a film career. She did a play called Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. Mm-hmm. It was a small play, but they decided to make it into a movie. And she talks about being in a movie theater when a trailer for this film came on. And when her name came on, the audience laughed. Mm. And her sort of sitting there being like, why are they laughing when they see my name? And her sort of realizing that she just wasn't cool. Like, in this moment, she wasn't cool. She was sort of that weird lady who, like, dressed up in costumes and did shows and sang funny songs. And so this was part of her, you know, comeback's kind of an annoying word, but in a way, a comeback or a reinvention of herself. And so she had made the film Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. She had been in Silkwood with Meryl Streep, directed by Mike Nichols, and it actually received an Academy Award nomination. She had done the film Mask and not gotten an Academy Award nomination, which even she made a bit of a big deal about. And she is incredible in that film. Like, her performance is amazing. And yeah, both Witches of Eastwick and a film called Suspect would come out this year. So this was really her establishing herself as, like, quote unquote, a serious actress. So this really was a moment for Cher.
Well, she's great.
She's fantastic. And we'll have many moments that we'll talk about specifically as we go along. And as she's walking, it is sort of funny how she's walking up Sullivan Street as we see a truck for the Metropolitan Opera Scenic Shop go by. And I will say the very next shot is the exact same street, but she's walking down the street instead.
Maybe she forgot something.
Yeah, she just had to go to the bodega and grab something, and now she's coming back.
Did you notice there's a man carrying a Christmas tree?
I did not notice that, and it's funny how it took me a minute to realize this was the holiday season.
Okay, because I noticed it, and I thought, oh, there's our NYC rom-com need. You need to have someone carrying a Christmas tree at all time. And then we, and that's also not uncommon that the Metropolitan Opera's scene shop is far away from the actual Metropolitan Opera. Like, building the set and then bringing it in. You know, that's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not a strange thing. And then we end up at the Nuccioroni, I think, funeral home.
Yeah, Nuccioroni. For the record, I am not Italian. There's so much Italian. I break down some of it. I translate a couple of things. To any of our Italian listeners, when I say something wrong, I beg your forgiveness. I'm very Norwegian, so I will try my best.
I am a little Italian, but most, like, the Italian and the Greek blended together. but it's mostly Greek. Like, no one is actually from, I don't know, it's just like some weird genealogical thing where they're actually Greek, but it says Italian, you know.
Sure,
very,
yeah.
Very close.
So we end up at 177 Sullivan, which is now several things. It's the Megan David of Manhattan Synagogue, it's the Sephardic Learning Center, and the Sunny and Al Gindi Community Center. But yeah, here it is, the Nucciaroni Funeral Home. Once again, the funny thing about this, because the camera swings from one side of the street to the other, literally on this side of the street, nothing has changed. Like, the colors of the buildings, the structure of the, like, everything's the same. And then you swing around and the other side actually has been remodeled quite a bit. And we start, I love this. We have an open casket. But what I love is that this is where Norman Jewison has chosen to put his credit. Just sort of over the open casket, like, dead bodies figure.
And I'm not really sure. This is, like, kind of the scenes where I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, who is everyone? Because I don't even know anyone's name. Like, I don't research their name, who they play, anything. I try to come to these films as, like, if I were watching it for the first time. So I don't know Cher's name is Loretta yet. I don't know anything.
Yeah, I do a little bit of both, because we meet a character here.
Al,
sure. But you know what? Hours from now, we're going to meet another Al who's going to be a bartender. And when I was looking at, because I was going to IMDb to try to be like, all right, who's this person and who is the actor? This person is Alfonso Conti, according to the nameplate sitting on the desk. So I figured he was Conti. In the credits, he's Conti. Tony Azito. And people are telling that he's a genius. But I did have more. Listen, there were aspects of this script. First of all, to go back and talk about John Patrick Shanley for a while, here's what I find fascinating about John Patrick Shanley. So a friend of mine did a play of his, Savage in Limbo, that literally reads as though it's almost a foreign language. Like, there are lines that my friend and I would break down being like, holy Moses, like the sentence structure of this is so bizarre to me. And then you have, like, once again, to zoom to the future, he will eventually write the play Doubt, which to me is so straightforward and, like, so easy to grasp. This is somewhere in the middle to me, where there are definitely moments where I'm like, what? Part of this reads like a Russian novel, where, like, everyone has three names and no one uses any of them. Where I'm like, wait, who is who? So yes, I did a bit of deciphering, but yes, in this case, we have Tony Azito, who, yeah, you're a genius. Tony Azito, for the record, was a Tony nominee and Drama Desk winner for Pirates of Penzance, but he's not good with paperwork and he's got butter on his tie.
Yeah, he's eating this bagel very Harry Goldenblatt style. Cher is doing the accounting, because at this point, remember, I don't know her name yet.
Sure.
So Cher is doing the accounting, and apparently we find out that Al makes them look better than they did when they were alive. So Al is the funeral director. He does the painting of the faces.
Well, but also I was like, all right, so Cher works for a funeral home.
Right.
That's her job.
No.
Okay, good to know.
Nope.
So then now we get to roses and red roses, very romantic. And this one too, I have Carmen, florist, Frank Geo.
Yeah.
Like, I did not know who this was.
Cher is now working at a flower shop.
Yes.
We find out her name is Loretta. So we can now refer to her as Loretta. We have named Cher. Carmine gives her a rose.
Yeah, we have a quick scene in which she comes across as not romantic, but also loves flowers.
Okay.
So I think we're kind of setting up that she's a little bit like, who cares about the roses? But then it's like, I actually do like a rose. You know,
yeah.
A little bit. We're setting up, I think, the conflict in her personality.
And what I thought at this moment was, okay, because my first job was working at an Italian bridal shop. And they were from Italy. And I had a lot of experience working around a large Italian family where everyone worked together. And I also knew that the person who did the accounting for the bridal shop also was the nephew who did the accounting for, you know, it was like everyone worked everywhere. So at this point I thought, okay, Cher is the accountant for all the family businesses. That's kind of where my brain was going. And I think I'm right.
Gotcha. I'm not sure that you're right, but like it makes it, she's, it does have credence.
She
for
handles
for sure.
The cash for all the family business, I think.
Or a lot of businesses, I'm not sure if they're all family or not, but a lot of businesses.
Well, I think they're family, like, if they're not related to her.
They're family.
They're family, yeah. And also, maybe she doesn't do a good job of it, as we learn. But anyway, moving on.
She's distracted. I will also say, and I don't have a ton of these, but much like you talking about how this is structured like an opera, the composer of this film, Dick Hyman, talked about how he actually did give everyone a theme. And I don't have everyone's theme, but I will say in this moment, what's playing is Canzone per Loretto, which is literally just song for Loretta.
Very romantic. The guy that sends these really knows what he's doing. guy who said so spends a lot of money on something that's going to end up in the garbage.
I'm glad everybody ain't like you, Loretta. I'd be out of business.
What are you talking? I love flowers. Thanks, Carmine.
So we are sort of setting up that everyone has their own, and you might have gotten into this, but no, we'll talk about it later. We'll talk about it later when we have more people on the scene. So now we cut to Hicks Street in Brooklyn, even though it's not really Hicks Street in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and we're at Grand Ticino, which no longer is with us.
It is not with us. This actually was on West 12th Street, where it meets West 4th Street. Yes, there's a strange place in New York where streets meet rather than streets and avenues. This is now Cafe Cluny, C-L-U-N-Y. And a little behind the scenes, the restaurant did not want them to film there. John Patrick Shanley had set this to be there, but they were like, well, we're a restaurant. Like, we're open. We don't want to close down for you to film here. And basically, he begged them to let them film there. And to his credit, for the next 2 years, their business went up like 150%. So it did end up profiting them. And we have Bobo the waiter.
Mm-hmm. Love Bobo.
Robert Weil. Yeah.
Love Bobo.
And we meet Mr. Johnny Camerari, Danny Aiello, which I assume most people at this point knew him most famously for playing Madonna's father in the Papa Don't Preach video.
Yes, I was going to say, like, Mike, do you know this? Did you know this before you saw him?
Okay, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and interesting thing about him is he wasn't an actor at first.
Yeah, his story is very interesting.
Yeah.
That he was, this is only his sixth credit. Like, he'd done a bit, and they're all six from this year. Like, literally, this is his sixth film credit, and all of them are from 1987. He had done theater, but he actually had been a Greyhound driver and union president.
He gives me union president vibes.
For 100%. I can see that. I can see a Hoffa going on there. And I like that he orders special fish.
Yes. Okay, so I wrote that there. So Johnny is with Loretta. He orders the special fish, and I think we just have to tell this story because it's very funny.
Is it a tellable story? Go for it.
Yeah, I'll tell it. I'll tell it. I'll make it tellable. So Mike and I used to often go, as you all know, to get nachos after work or after, you know, we recorded. And one time we went after work with our friend Ben, and we were walking home, and Ben is like the type that after like one or two drinks, the first thing that goes is his speech. So he talks drunker than he actually is. And this is what was happening. And what he was trying to say is, we were passing this store on 9th Avenue that has paintings in the window. And there was a painting of a red-haired lady holding a plate with a fish on it. What he was trying to say is, look, Elise, it's you with the special fish at work. Or like the fish that was the special at work. Like, that's it. But what he did was walked by and pointed at was, Elise, it's you, special fish.
Which is all that I could think when he ordered special fish.
And we're like, what did you just say? And he goes, it's you, special fish. And I'm like,
it's you, work special fish.
Yeah, that's all. So anytime I see that, I just thought, it's you, special fish. So yes, he orders the special fish and the Ticino salad. Loretta says not to order the special fish. It's oily. She orders the manicotti.
And I was a tiny bit confused here on my first view / listen, because I thought she said, in my mind... And this has nothing to, this is just me. In my mind, they're going to the Met tonight. And I don't know why I had that in my brain, but for some reason I thought they're having dinner and then they're going to go to the opera. And they aren't. Like, it just was a thing that I made up. Mm-hmm. But I thought here she said, you don't want to have fish before the play.
Plane.
And what she says, yeah, she says you don't want it before the plane. But I did not hear that. So there were several things that are going to happen in the next 5 minutes that were very confusing.
No,
to me.
You don't want to have fish before the plane. And I thought they were going on a trip together.
He makes the point of, you look out for me.
Yeah.
And we get an idea here that that Loretta is a bit of a caretaker, that she's sort of the one who's making sure that people are making the right choices.
Now, this will also make more sense later in the film, but I thought with the way Cher's hair is, they have it pulled back, you definitely see the gray in it. I thought they were trying to age her. I had no idea what her age was, but in this, I thought she was trying to be old play. I thought they were trying to age Cher into being a woman in her late 40s, early 50s.
And in reality, she's playing a character younger than she is in real life.
Right. And so I thought, and also because Johnny is older than her. So
correct.
I thought that she was supposed to be older. So that was my thinking when I saw her. And then we see Patricia and the professor.
Yeah, Perry and Patricia. And you know, Patricia's played by Linda Howard. I don't know a ton about her. She has several credits, but this is a little early on in her career. But, you know, John Mahoney plays Perry, and this is a fairly early credit, and he cites this as his big break. And just, we'll get a little more into him later on, but he was at this point, he'd been a member of Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater Company since 1979.
He wasn't Frasier's dad yet.
He was not, no. But they're having an argument about how she states her aspirations.
Yes.
And the funny thing is, we don't know what his career is, and we'll save it till the reveal, but it's funny when we finally get there.
Well, we must, because I have written the professor.
Sure, but I guess we don't know what a professor, what kind of professor he is.
Right, but she does mention that he is a professor,
yeah.
Or he mentions that he is a professor. And she eventually tells him to kiss her aspirations, throws water at him, and leaves. And then he says his signature line.
Would you do away with her dinner and any evidence of her and bring me a big glass of wine? But Epsom.
And I'm wondering, any evidence of her at this meal? Or is he like calling for
scrub
a hit?
Scrub her from the world.
Yeah. Yikes.
And then, I don't know, Johnny having his little like laugh moment and saying a man who can't control his woman is funny.
Yeah.
To which Loretta just comes back with like, she's just too young for him.
Right. But I think that says two things. I think also... It's 1987. I think it's also, I like that has no, it doesn't phase Loretta. I think it says more about Loretta than it does about him. Because I think like the fact that she's like, she's too young for him means that Loretta doesn't take bullshit. And she's also kind of like unfazed by that mentality. I think maybe she's had that a lot with her parents, as we eventually will see.
It's funny, there's an article written in the Blu-ray, and this article talks about how binary this film is, which I think is interesting. They talk about how it's such a contrast between night and day, and even gender roles between man and woman, and that, but part of what that binary is it does leave room for the shades in between. So yeah, I think it's an interesting point that you make, that this is a very like men are in control statement that the woman kind of takes and is like, I don't give a fuck about what you just said. Let's just move on. You know, like, so yeah, it is,
right.
It is interesting. And
because I do think that maybe just because I've grown up seeing these types of women, like my dad would have never said something like that. But my mom is the type of woman that if anyone ever said that, she wouldn't like scream at them. She would just be like, shut up. Like, it's just that thing where it's like, you need to say that obviously for yourself, but no one, yeah.
Yeah, I always think of my mom saying like, somebody to the effect of like, your dad tells me how he's going to vote, but he doesn't know what I do when I go behind the voting curtain. So
right.
I think there's a certain amount of like, okay, you're in charge, but I'm going to do what I want to do.
She's like, I poop in there.
You know, you got to do what you got to do. So we cut to Bobo and Shy Waiter, I think is this character's name. And we find out that Johnny is planning on proposing. And we sort of have like, he's going to give the hand signal and then I'm supposed to bring over the champagne. And he's been a good bachelor customer for 20 years.
Yeah. And what I find confusing about this moment is it seems like what from Bobo is saying, that Johnny has put some thought into this proposal.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not sure what happens next, but we get to coffee service and Loretta asking for the check, but Johnny wants to see the dessert cart. And I love her thing of like, you never have dessert. Yeah, forever's a long time.
Yeah, and then he itches his head because his scalp doesn't get enough blood sometimes. And where I thought this was going to go, and maybe it's just because I'm traumatized from And Just Like That, is that they were alluding to the fact that Johnny has a circulation issue. He's going to get on the plane and he's going to die.
Not everyone dies, Elise. I know you're hurting inside. But
I know, but that's just, you know, I'm always trying to plan ahead. And then we have a perfect screenshot of some 65% full salt and pepper shakers. And Johnny just looks at her and says, will you marry me? And then Loretta says, Bobo, take the card away.
Yeah, I love it. Cher's reaction is so good.
And like, I decided, so, like, yes, that's going to be
deadpan.
What I say now when someone asks me something I'm not ready to answer. Like if someone says,
say,
like,
Bobo, take the card away.
Bobo, take the card away. Like that's just going to be my new response when someone asks me a difficult question I'm not ready to talk about.
And we get a bit of an information dump here. We do find out that Loretta has been married before, her husband died, and she talks about how she thinks they had bad luck because they got married at City Hall. They didn't do any of it right. And she basically asks him to kneel down, and he talks about his expensive suit. And I love, like, I know, it's, I was there when you bought it. It came with two pairs of pants.
And now he's awkwardly crawling on his knees to her, but he doesn't have a ring. And this is where I got confused, because didn't he set up with Bobo everything? He didn't think to propose or have a ring.
I literally wrote, where's the ring? I don't fully understand this.
Yeah, so he uses his pinky ring. She says yes. The whole restaurant is happy. Bobo is emotional. He should have just thought this through a little bit more.
Well, I'm going to also now get into my little thing that I mean and don't mean, which is the whole idea of the engagement ring. Because I've heard conflicting things about engagement rings and whether they're a long-lasting tradition or whether they're a thing that's been made up. And I guess I did learn, all right, here's some fun information for everybody, that the first engagement ring is dated back to 1477, when the Archduke Maximilian of Austria proposed to Mary of Burgundy. But they weren't even then a thing. Like, they didn't become popular until De Beers did an ad campaign in 1938. Mm. And then in 1947, the term a diamond is forever was invented. And I will say that between 1939 and 1979, diamond sales rose from 23 million to 2.1 billion. So it is a fairly recent thing, but, you know, I kind of see both sides. I get that it's nice. And, you know, part of this came from the whole idea that a woman who had been proposed to, who then the wedding was called off, could be looked at as, like, perhaps a ruined woman. And if it was the man's fault that it was called off, she at least got to keep the ring, which gave her a certain, like, financial security. So
it's like collateral almost.
Maybe. Yeah, a little bit. A bit like, I'm putting a payment down on you.
Right. It's almost like putting, like, a good faith deposit. Like, yeah.
Basically. I'll be back to pay for the rest later. And I like that someone gets shushed at the door. I like that there's, like, talking and the host is like, shh.
And so now we cut to Cher driving.
Okay, can we talk about this? Because this is a flaw. This is a 100% flaw that I accepted for a minute because I thought they were going to the Met. So they're going through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, which is now the Hugh L. Carey Tunnel. For the record, the longest continuous underwater vehicular tunnel in North America. But they're definitely going to Manhattan. So if the idea is that this restaurant, though the restaurant actually is physically in Manhattan, they're pretending as though it's in Brooklyn. That's why they put up the street sign to make us think that it's Brooklyn. So now they're driving from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And I guess let's just leave it at that. We'll get to the what I see as the flaw later. Because we have the whole conversation as they're driving through the tunnel about, like, what about the wedding? And now we find out that he has to wait for his mother to die, which should be in a week or two.
Yeah, he is driving and he's asking about Cher is driving and asking about the wedding. His mother is dying, but she wants a wedding and wants to know when. And then after they've decided when he'll be back, they decide on a month.
I thought we set a date. How about a month?
To be so definite. Can't we just say we'll be married when I get back?
Where? At the city hall? No.
My mother is dying.
I want a whole wedding or we'll have bad luck. And for a whole wedding to be planned, you gotta set a date.
All right, all right. A month.
A month from today.
In a month.
A month from today.
Oh, yes, a month from today.
Okay,
from today, right.
Okay,
today, okay. Today.
All right. I'll take care of it, Johnny. I'll take care of the whole thing. All you gotta do is show up.
Yikes, that gives me scary Mr. Big Carey vibes.
And now we're at the airport, and I'm just assuming, because later on we will definitely be at JFK, that they're at JFK.
Yeah, I think just don't let your brain get caught up in all of this. They're driving. We don't have to know where they drove or how they got there.
When I thought they were going to the Met, I thought, well, I just thought, like, okay, well, they're driving to Manhattan to go to this, but they're not. So why would you go from Brooklyn to Manhattan to go to JFK, which is, yeah, okay. This is just a thing that threw me. Like, I don't get why they were driving through the tunnel, but okay.
Well, maybe they had to pick up his suitcase. He might live in Little Italy, too. So maybe they had to go to Manhattan to get his suitcase. He didn't have it with him.
Guess so. Seems like a waste of a drive, but sure.
Yeah, so they're at the airport, and Johnny lets Loretta know that he wants her to call his younger brother that he doesn't talk to anymore. He wants to make sure Ronnie, his younger brother, is invited to the wedding. And he gives Loretta Ronnie's number on a card. What's also interesting is this is when you could, like, be with someone at the gate while it was boarding.
For sure, yeah. And it's funny seeing, like, all the actual tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part one of Moonstruck. If you want to hear the rest and our take on You've Got Mail, When Harry Met Sally, Bros, and more, head on over to our website or Patreon to sign up. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at StillWonderingNYC, Elise Castle at Evie Castle, and me at MikeJensen77.
Is Doubt coming back to Broadway? Is that what?
It is coming back, yeah. Okay. Tyne Daly, Liev Schreiber, I believe.
Love,
yeah.
Tyne Daly.
It's weird when, like, a play that I saw the original version of is being revived. I'm like, wait, how old am I? Okay.
Doubt is the math one?
No, that's Proof. Doubt is the sister Aloysius that Cherry Jones won the Tony Award for.
I get Doubt, Wit, and Proof.
You know what? They're all one name. They all won the Pulitzer. Did Wit? Right. Doubt and Proof definitely both did. I think Wit did as well.
Like, and Proof is the one like the son or the father and daughter.
Yes.
Okay. I get them all confused and I'm just like a mess all the time. Al's eating a bagel.
My point being.
Sorry.
What's that?
Al's eating a bagel.
Tony nominee and Drama Desk winner for Pirates of the Penzance.
Pirates of Penzance.
For Pirates of Penzance. Whatever. Put a fucking thumb there. But he's not good with paperwork and he's got butter on his tie.